The schools, they're supposed to be reopening on Thursday and crunch talks are taking place. We're joined now by the General Secretary of the Teaching Union of Ireland. That's Michael Gillespie. Good afternoon and happy 2022 to you. A quiet one, Michael?
Not so far, I don't think so, Ciara. It's been busy, to say the least, yeah.
I mean, you look back at, you know, January 2021. Do you feel like the unions were in this sort of situation back then?
No, I think it was different then. We didn't have people fully vaccinated. There was an awful lot of nervousness. There was a lot of hospitalizations at the time. So I think schools were in a completely different position. Now, obviously, we're vaccinated. We're dealing with Omicron, which, of course, is far more transmissible, which is creating the numbers that you're speaking about there. So, no, it is different. There's no doubt it is different. But nevertheless, still worrying and concerning for people in schools. And one of the biggest factors I suppose we're going to face on Thursday is not knowing how many people are going to be available for school. Now, that's both students and teachers. It's not just teachers. Obviously, we've got a large number of people isolating. We have a large number of people awaiting PCR tests or queuing for PCR tests. We've had people who contacting us saying they did antigen tests on the 26th, 27th of December and still haven't got in for a PCR test. So a lot of uncertainty out there as well.
Now, if we go back to October time, probably the majority at the time of people who were being infected with the virus were children of primary school going age in particular. Now, we know from yesterday, was it the registration for the portal for 5 to 11 year olds to receive a third of a Pfizer dose that would an adult would be given opened. And we know, you know, over 50, 60,000 registrations did take place over the past couple of days, which is amazing numbers if you do decide to obviously get vaccinated. And you're mentioning there things are different when it comes to not only students who may be able to turn up, but a lot of those students may have already been infected just a couple of months ago. And it's now kind of moved on to staff. We know it's happening throughout the country, no matter what sector you're working in, but it is worrying for those going back into the classroom that they may not have a teacher come 9 o'clock on Thursday morning.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why we are calling for each school to have to decide on a case-by-case basis what they're going to have to do. Hopefully they'll be all able to open up, but we have to put into place contingencies. So, for example, in second level, it's slightly different than in the national school because obviously we have, you know, you don't meet the same teacher for each class during the day. It's subject-specific. So we may be missing certain subject teachers for, you know, it's hard to predict who's not going to be in on Thursday yet. Some schools may only miss one or two teachers. Other schools may miss eight or nine, but may have subs. Other schools have the hope of getting a sub because obviously before we ever got into this crisis, we had a supply and even a recruitment issue in terms of teaching. We couldn't supply substitutes. And we now, you know, at certain times of year, we can't even recruit teachers into certain subjects in second level. So this is on top of that. You know, we have now this crisis, you know.
Now, if we're talking about the schools themselves deciding what the situation would be for them, the unions are saying that's essential for reopening to happen. Is it about a quota, Michael? Is it a certain percentage of the teachers that are available? Because I have heard of stories where students who were not studying teaching, whether that was second level or primary level, coming in and having to basically look over the children over the past couple of weeks because the schools themselves were already short on staff back then. So obviously we're in a much worse case in terms of numbers than we were back in October, November, even early December time.
Well, that's what we'll be hoping will come out of the meeting today with the minister, that we will come up with some metrics as to what will be the save. Now, obviously, you know, if we weren't even in a COVID situation, we have certain health and safety issues that must be arrived at in certain schools. In other words, we have a minimum level of supervision and substitution that is required. There's a duty of care to the students by teachers. And the duty of care, of course, is dependent on age. The younger the child, the more, you know, the higher the level of duty of care that's required. So we'd already have guidelines in that in schools that we'd have to operate on.
So what are you asking Minister Foley this afternoon? Clarity in terms of antigen testing?
Well, clarity, first of all, a lot of people don't know. I mean, this is across the board. You know, when does the 10 days start? Does the 10 days now start when I've done an antigen test, when I get a PCR test? You know, is there the changes we had just before Christmas of the 5 days for close contacts and then household rules? So there needs to be greater clarity as to when does the clock start ticking. Therefore, you know, if I, when am I, and I'm, we'll say, symptom free or whatever, what day can I return to work? That needs to be put down in a simple document now. It's got very confusing over the last couple of months, so that needs to be simplified. Obviously, as we said, we need, if we do have to, you know, if a school is not capable of looking after all the students, we have to prioritize. And we believe that students in special education class, in special ed classes, students with special educational needs or additional education needs should be prioritized, along with the students who are in with a junior cycle or leaving cert applied, people who are going doing exams. They should be prioritized. If there is, if a school doesn't have the capacity to deal with all the students that they have under their care. We also think that, like, we've been looking for HEPA filters and mechanical ventilation in schools for the last several months. And, you know, the delays in trying to get that sorted out and get professional advice into schools as to what's needed is getting to the point of being ridiculous at this stage. I mean, we now know the classrooms in a school, for example, that have poor ventilation, or that if we want to bring down the CO2 levels, we have to open the windows to unacceptable levels where everybody's freezing. We need to be able to invest in those classrooms. There are not that many of them, and put in mechanical ventilation that will help with ventilation, not just in 2022, but in 2023, 2024, long-term investment. And that's also going to benefit us in flu land, you know, when we go back to, hopefully when we go back to the normal life of trying to prevent other infections in schools. Mm. So, I mean, long-term investment, you know, a lot of delays on lots of things that could be in place. Obviously now, because we've got Omicron, which is far more transmissible, you know, we need more specific guidelines on masks. Other jurisdictions have, you know, introduced masks even outdoors because of Omicron. We'd be calling for, you know, specific guidelines on the types of masks that should be used.
And just obviously you're mentioning a lot there in terms of ventilation, yeah, etc. But just going back a little when it comes to actually, would say, bodies in the classroom and obviously adults that are able to supervise these children, whether they're the teachers or not, obviously due to high numbers of COVID cases and isolating, etc. Is it even safe right now if I was a parent? Do I even want to be letting my child go into the classroom? Will you potentially be discussing with Minister Foley that maybe schools do need to shut for a little while?
Well, obviously schools have mitigation we know that works, you know, once it's been enforced. And the most important thing about mitigation and most, is to keep people who are infected out of school, to keep the spread out, which, you know, we never agreed with the language that was sometimes used, that schools are safe. They're not safe, but they can be made as safe as possible by using the mitigation measures. So once we, you know, use social distancing, which there are diagrams for every classroom in the country now, been set up since for nearly 2 years, we have mask wearing is compulsory. We do have a vaccinated population over 12 and very, very high numbers of vaccination. So what we intend to do is hopefully make schools as safe as possible using CO2 meters. Now, they're not going to be safe, and there's going to be a spread of Omicron. And, you know, I know, you know, some people are getting very mild doses. You know, I suppose Delta is still around, which can cause more severe illness. But we hope that we will be making schools as safe as possible until we get over this peak, which has been predicted, you know, to last sometime until the middle of January.
Okay, well, Michael Gillespie, I really appreciate the time. Obviously, a lot on your plate in regards to everybody in the education sector over the next few hours and few days, but we will hear more about that later on this evening. The General Secretary of the Teaching Union of Ireland, thank you so much, Michael. Take care of yourself. And of course, again, a happy 2022 to you. And Michael was just noting in terms of isolating and what the story is, if, you know, you've had a vaccination 5 days, 10 days, etc., etc. So if you have received the first round of your COVID-19 vaccination, as in you've gotten your two doses of, you know, AstraZeneca, Pfizer, BioNTech, Moderna, or the one dose of Janssen, and you have been classified as a close contact, you need to do the antigen testing, but you also need to restrict your movements, stay at home for 10 days. That's if you did not receive a booster vaccine yet. Now, if you have received a booster vaccine, you have to do the antigen testing, which is the 5 antigen tests with 2 days between each test. So you do a test on day 1, you do a test on day 3, and you do a test on day 5. And if you're negative, negative for all of those, then that's fine. This is in terms of if you've had a booster and only restrict your movements for 5 days. Obviously, if you develop symptoms of COVID-19, you need to isolate and get a PCR test depending on your age group. I know they're saying for people below the age of 39 to do the antigen testing. We were speaking earlier about our antigen test being able to got. And Caoimhe Harney is currently isolating at the moment, and she let us know that she ordered her antigen test yesterday morning. Her brother ordered his at 8 p.m. yesterday evening, and both of those packages arrived in the post at about 10 to 11 this morning. So if anybody is worried and you're at home isolating, or you've just heard you're a close contact and you want to get your hands on PCR testing, get on the website as soon as possible to try and get your hands on that. And it looks as if the government are doing a quick turnaround in terms of the antigens. In terms of sleep, I think a lot of people out there need help, especially on the first day back to work in January. Joining me now is Joanne Callaghan, sleep expert. How are you?
Hi, Ciara. How are you? Fantastic.
I have to say my eyelids are a little heavy this morning. I woke up really early, like extra early than I normally do. It's kind of like, you know, when you know you have to go back to school and you do, your body kind of wakes itself before you need to. So I was up at about 5 o'clock this morning. I would not normally be up until about 6:30. So it was a bit too early for me, Joanne.
Yeah, well, a lot of people are getting back into the new routine again after Christmas. This is actually my first official day back to work, and I have to say I did struggle a little bit, even though I'm the sleep expert, I did struggle. So yes, we do all experience that. But yeah, it's the routine and the rhythms and all of that that's at bay, yeah, with all this.
So Joanne, if you are somebody who has had your pattern obviously a bit disturbed and disrupted over Christmas, what are the steps you take, would say, within the next couple of days to feel, I guess, back to normal? Because it is difficult when you're so tired going about your daily activities. A first world problem, but it can be really difficult.
Absolutely. It can take a long time to wake up. It can affect your mood. It can affect so many different physiological aspects and emotional health as well. So really getting back into rhythm is key to all of this, because we are we live by this circadian rhythm, this 24-hour biological process. And if we're out of sync, everything is out of whack. It's like if you're traveling, jet lag, anything like that, that's the same thing as well. So really steps to get back into rhythm. The first thing that I say to people is, you know, get up at the same time every morning. So it might be a struggle the first day or so getting back into the routine. But look, if you feel you didn't sleep well the night before and you need a nap, you can have a nap in the afternoon. But the key is to actually wake up at the same time, because this is a cue for your body. It's resetting this internal body clocks, the body rhythm, if you like. So that's the first thing, is waking up at the same time every morning. And then the next thing I'd say is, as early as you can, get out and get natural daylight. So the sunshine is a very important cue to this timing, the timing of the body clocks. The sunshine also has the vitamin D, which is very important for our immune system. But it's also been shown that we do have vitamin D receptors in our brain and the sleep centers in our brain. So it's very much associated with our sleep and patterns as well. And daylight just basically re-kicks everything again. We need sunshine. So they're the two key things. There's a lot of other things, but they'd be the two key things that I would say to people.
Okay, Joanne, you mentioned napping, and that's something that you hear conflicting things about. Some people say never nap, some people say do. If you are to nap, how long should you nap for? Should you set an alarm on your phone or whatever you have around you?
Short naps are ideal. If you feel that you need to take a nap, if you've had a nap, like for mothers or, you know, people with young children, if you have sleep disturbance during the night with young kids or whatever, you may need, definitely I'd recommend a nap there. But a short nap, because if you sleep for like an hour or 2 hours, you're actually going into a deep phase of sleep, and it's eaten into your sleep drive, so you won't be as tired come the night time. But a short power nap for half an hour is enough to recover your brain and give you enough energy to continue throughout the day. So that would be ideal, 30 minutes or so, no more.
Yeah, since a lot of people have gotten the sleep apps, or would say the tech watches, and you can now follow your sleep, it is really interesting when you see yourself wake up out of different patterns. You're mentioning deep sleep. You can actually feel really tired if you wake up in the middle of a deep sleep. So how do you, I guess, without maybe knowing or having like one of those watches or apps or whatever, how do you time yourself to know that by the time you do need to wake up, for whether that's you're one of those people who your body is able to naturally wake you up, or you've obviously set an alarm, how do you know that you're going through the right stages of sleep, like REM, that's rapid eye movement, and then the light sleep stages, and obviously the deep sleep?
Great question. Absolutely great question. It's one that I get a lot. So really, I think you know if you're getting good quality sleep if you wake up refreshed. That's it, simple and short and sweet. If you wake up refreshed, full of energy, you've gotten your deep sleep, because the deep sleep is vital for all the healing and repair and the brain recovery. It's vital for your immune system, your and the detoxification process. Your whole body goes through a whole detoxification. So if you, it's like, you know, when you're putting the rubbish in the rubbish bin, you need to take it out and get rid of it and dispose of it. Well, that's what happens at night time. And if you don't, everything slows down, it gets sluggish. So you feel sharp, bright, fresh when you've had that deep sleep and all that detoxification process has happened, all the healing and repair. So in terms of quantity as well, so some people say, well, you know, I only need a certain number of hours or whatever. Each individual is very, very different, and we have a different biodiversity, individuality. So it's up to each individual to be empowered to know how much hours. Now, typically for an adult, it's 7 to 9 hours of sleep. But it's up to each individual to discover how much sleep they actually need. And again, it's when you can wake up refreshed without an alarm clock. So many of us need to wake up with an alarm clock because our wake-up time is socially determined. But if you can wake up without an alarm clock, then that's, your body has had enough sleep when you wake up naturally.
So and I mean, really, it's so much nicer to wake up naturally, isn't it? But how do I know if I'm getting enough sleep? Because are there some people out there who just aren't great at waking up? Because I'm really, like, I'm fine in terms of my mood in the morning, but I'm really bad, Joanne, at actually waking up. I'm there in the bed like, no, I'm actually so bad at it. Like, there is something wrong with me. Since I was a child, I'd have to be pulled out of the bed, you know, when it had come to school. Once I'm up, I'm fine. But, like, I don't think I ever wake up feeling refreshed in those few moments. Is there something wrong with me?
I know I'm laughing, Ciara, but you're not alone. There's a lot of people like that. And again, it can come back to our body clocks and rhythms. So there are some night owls and morning larks, and various different people fit into those different categories. So now there are very few natural night owls, like just maybe 15-16% who are natural night owls. Some people call themselves night owls, but it's just bad habits. I'm sorry to say for those people. But so it's down to habits and going to bed at a reasonable time and waking up at a reasonable time. But what you do during the daytime will determine how well you sleep during the night. But also, waking up in the morning time, we have cortisol and melatonin. Melatonin is the sleep hormone, and then cortisol is the opposite hormone that works in relation to melatonin. So like that dancing parent, as I call them. So your melatonin needs to be switched off in the morning for your cortisol. Your cortisol is highest in the morning, and it needs to be. People think cortisol is the baddie, but we need cortisol to get us up and out of bed and moving. So you may need to do something to reset your circadian rhythm to wake you up, to switch off that melatonin. And daylight is probably the best remedy. Some people go for the morning cup of coffee for, you know, it's a stimulant. But if you want to do it naturally, get outside and get natural daylight as early as you can, first thing in the morning. Open your blinds up. I know it's wintertime and it's cold outside at the moment, but that is the best thing that can switch off that melatonin is morning daylight.
Okay, I've got a couple of questions for you here. And in regards to daylight, I actually bought myself one of those Lumi lights. Do you know those? I bought one of those. Not the gradual one. The one that has the, I don't know, 2000 watts or whatever. Because I was speaking to Dr. Harry Barry before, the psychologist, and he was speaking about how in these months, obviously, we do. You're mentioning the light. I think it is harder for Irish people when it comes to the colder months to get up.
Absolutely.
But I've got a couple of questions here. So one comes in from Jimmy Galloway, and he says that he's a friend of yours and he hasn't spoke to you in about 10 years. So Jimmy obviously wants to say hello to you.
Hi,
so
Jim,
reconnecting people in 2022.
It's a small world.
He would like to ask you if after a TIA in October and then being put on sleeping tablets to help, would these be the reason I am not sleeping like I did before my TIA, which is a mini stroke?
Yeah, so sleeping tablets, look, there's a place and a time for sleeping tablets, but really they're, now I'm not a doctor, okay, but sleeping tablets are really designed for short-term use, and what happens is people can become addicted to them physically, like, you know, and then on an emotional level, some people feel, oh God, I can't go to sleep, I need to have my tablets, so they can be addicted to it in that sense as well. So what sleeping tablets do is, yes, they may help you. They help you to sleep, but I'm not actually getting the true sleep. And this is where we're not getting the deep sleep. So this is why, you know, sometimes it's good to have sleeping tablets if you absolutely need to sleep. There's a lot of stress, worry, concerns, depression going on at the moment. So we absolutely need to get some level of sleep. And this sleeping tablets can be a way of helping you in the short term, so you can put other things in place that will help you without the need for sleeping tablets.
And Joanne Brona in Newbridge got in touch, and she's asking how best to wind down before sleep.
Yeah, so winding down before bed is really, really important. It's crucial because sleep is not an on-off switch. You know, your body temperature has to cool down. This is super important for the hormones, for the nighttime hormones to come on. Our blood pressure, our heart rate, all this has to slow down for the onset of sleep. So this is why, you know, the wind down hour before sleep is really important. It's critical we don't have mobile phones. A lot of people are checking the news now, getting up to date with the news on their mobile phones, bringing the phones to bed at nighttime. It's the worst thing you can do for many reasons. There's the blue light that stops your melatonin. It excites the brain, and we want the brain to slow down. We want the brain waves to slow down. And also dopamine. Dopamine becomes heightened, and dopamine is what has us be addicted, and we can't put the phone down. So there's a lot going on. We absolutely need to turn off those mobile phones, turn on your plane mode, whatever, and turn your Wi-Fi off at night time as well. So there's lots of things you can do.
Read
to
a
wind
book.
Down.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the best advice. There's so many people, like I myself, I don't have trouble with getting to sleep at all. I obviously like sleep a lot. I like to stay asleep in the morning. But like, I do note that some people I know in particular really find it difficult to sleep. And when you are finding it difficult to sleep, you do tend to reach for your techie items, don't you? Like your phone and just check what's going on.
It's the worst thing you can do. To get a worry journal, a lot of people are worried at the moment. There's a lot of concerns. There's a lot of uncertainty. Get a worry journal. Start using your worry journal. Literally just write it out in a piece of paper, because you're actually physically, you're moving it from your head onto a piece of paper. Or if there's things that you need to do tomorrow that you don't want to forget, again, write it down in a piece of paper so it's actually stored somewhere but not in your head. Mm-hmm. And breathing is a fantastic thing to do at nighttime to help slow everything down, because you're actually activating your vagus nerve, which turns on that rest and digest part of the nervous system, which you absolutely need to for the onset of sleep. So breathing is a fantastic tool to use.
Okay, well, I can't wait to go to sleep this evening, Joanne. I appreciate all these tips, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners do too. And obviously, Jimmy, we say hi to you and thanks for texting in, and Brona and all the rest of you have your questions. But obviously, we only have a certain amount of time, and I want to thank you so much, sleep expert Joanne Callaghan, and a very happy 2022 to you. Now, you may have heard me mentioning a few moments ago about the Irish Red Cross. They're appealing for new volunteers here in this county. It's to bolster its family and community support efforts. They've seen an increase of 7,500% in demand. This is a result of the pandemic. Now, joining me to discuss this is Charles Lamson, the head of fundraising with the Irish Red Cross. It's good afternoon to you, Charles.
Hi, Ciara. How are you?
Good, good. Thank you. Absolutely massive number. I don't think I've ever seen 7,500% increase in demand for anything over the pandemic. We know a lot of services, whether it's domestic abuse, whether it's charities in general, obviously have seen a demand in their services. But that number is quite hard to believe.
Yeah, it's incredible, actually. It's just it's a result of, and a lot of this is going for community support, for elderly, for vulnerable, for people in rural communities. And really, I mean, typically, before the pandemic, we would have been providing, say, a few hundred calls per year. And when I say calls, I mean visits out to people directly to their homes to provide things like, you know, medicines, food for people that aren't able to get to the shops, you know, transfers to GP visits, et cetera, to a whole host of different things. But because of the pandemic, we've actually, since March of 2020, we're up to 15,000 visits for people across the country. So it really has been, you know, an incredible rise in demand, you know. And because of that, obviously, we're really appealing to people out there that if they're interested in getting involved in their communities and supporting a lot of the vulnerable, you know, people within their areas, is to give us a call or to go to our website, and we'd love to talk to you about volunteering.
Now, it says here that there are over 90 volunteers here in County Kildare. You're obviously calling for more. Exactly what would be the prime number of volunteers, would say, in a county like Kildare? Because we do have a very big population.
It's a big population, so it's pretty spread out. So rather, I mean, I don't think there's, you know, per se a specific optimum number, as much as having representation from across the area, so we're able to get to people, you know, in a really timely way.
Okay, yeah.
So it's that kind of being able to, if somebody does call, oftentimes when they do call, it's, you know, they really need some attention, you know, with a pretty quick turnaround. And so, if we're, you know, the more volunteers we have and the better the spread we have across the area, we're able to get out to people more quickly.
Now, it's also noted that the increase of testing, because obviously Delta and the Omicron variants are more transmissible, and probably any other that come along will probably be more transmissible too. Unfortunately, I know people don't want to hear that. But this means that there's been, again, huge demand on the National Ambulance Service with the units, having made nearly 1,000 patient transfers. That's since March 2020, when we went into lockdown in this country.
Yeah, it's incredible. And it's been, I mean, for a lot of this, again, going back to the core of what the Red Cross is doing, which is providing that extra support for people in need, it would be, you know, typically what we will be doing is in addition to ambulance service and trained ambulance drivers and you know, paramedic support and all of that kind of thing, it is also just we're looking for drivers and people to be there to take somebody, again, to that GP appointment, to take them to a dental appointment, to transfer them for things, you know, more serious things like chemotherapy or dialysis, you know, scheduled doctor's appointments that they need to be able to get to. I mean, it's just with the whole health system being inundated as well. I mean, it's just, you know, there's just so much overrun that we're looking for that additional support as much as we can.
Now, people may have heard on our news a little earlier on that hospitals are being told to cancel non-urgent care for the next 2 weeks. Now, we have heard this, you know, we know COVID-19 is obviously, you know, at the top of the priority list when it comes to this country and basically all countries globally. But illnesses still happen elsewhere. And that was one of the things that obviously the Red Cross do in terms of, you know, bringing people to chemotherapy and dialysis appointments, et cetera, et cetera. Just on the ground, what are you hearing from people? Do they feel let down? Do they feel worried for their health in other areas? Obviously, because unfortunately, the focus isn't there at the moment on things like cancer services.
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge amount of concern there, you know, as you can imagine. I mean, the number of people that are, again, going back to what we started talking about, is people that are more isolated in rural communities that aren't able to get out as frequently. I mean, the anxiety that comes with that. I mean, this, unfortunately, is, I think, a story that a lot of us know, and perhaps a lot of us would have family members, you know, going through some of that concern, is what do I do if I've, you know, if I've got to get to that appointment? So there is a lot of anxiety, which actually ties into part of the support that we're providing, and going back to the original point, beyond the ambulance support itself, or that driving people to their appointments, is, you know, the visits, the community support that we're providing. A lot of what we do and a lot of what our volunteers provide are check-ins. And that in normal times would have been a visit out to the door, you know, to knock on the door and say, hey, how you doing? Where we are now is we're doing a lot of phone calls, a lot of, you know, Zoom and Teams meetings, and just, again, letting, you know, checking in with people to see how they're doing and to have that support. So if they're feeling that kind of anxiety that we're talking about, you know, they know that there's somebody there that's looking after them, that is aware of their circumstance. And if it does, you know, come to a situation of they need to get to that dialysis treatment or what have you, there's somebody there to help them get there.
Charles, how can one volunteer?
So to volunteer, there's a number of ways. In Kildare, there's a branch in Kildare, and they actually have a Facebook page. So I would recommend people going to Facebook and looking up Kildare Red Cross branch. Or they can go to redcross.ie/volunteer-in-your-community. And you can find us there. Or simply, if that's too much over the radio, is simply just go to redcross.ie, and there's a tab there for volunteering, and we'd love to hear from you.
Brilliant. And Charles, just in regards to volunteering, what are the ages that you're looking for?
We have a youth program as well as all the way up through older members of society. So we've got, you know, some of our volunteers are we literally have youth members as young as 4 years old. So they're in some circumstances, we have, you know, three generations of one family that are volunteering, you know.
That's very cool. Very cool. Well, look, it was lovely to speak with you. Thank you so much for letting us know. And obviously all the details there Charles has given out. If you do want to volunteer here in County Kildare, or if you're listening elsewhere, obviously volunteers still needed everywhere across this country. And we'll have more information on KFM Radio in the next hour or so. But Charles Lamson, Head of Fundraising with the Irish Red Cross, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thanks for your time. Have a good day.
Now, some people in January are also trying new things such as Veganuary. And people have been asking, is it a gimmick at this stage? But there's lots of athletes out there, you know, high performance athletes saying that they see great benefits from it, unexpected benefits of switching to a vegan diet. And a lot of people are just asked to take the chance. Joining me now is Dr. Roger Yates. He's an organising volunteer for the Dublin-based Vegan Information Project. Good afternoon to you, Dr. Yates.
Hi, Kira. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm always really interested in Veganuary. Myself, I'm a celiac, so it's kind of difficult for me at times to, would say, even have a vegan meal because a lot of the times could have wheat, etc. But for most people, switching to plant-based seems to be at its easiest stage at the moment, especially when it comes to our local supermarkets.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, Veganuary has kind of given a bit of a, I don't know, a business opportunity to, for supermarkets. So a lot of them are kind of latching on in that sense, you know.
Okay, and obviously, you know, if you are trying to encourage people, or not even encourage people, are deciding to go for a more plant-based lifestyle, what advice would you have for them, Dr. Yates? And I guess coming away from the kind of gimmicky commercial side of the situation.
Yeah, well, that's the important part, actually, because the research suggests that if people engage with the ethics of veganism, then they tend to stay vegan. Whereas if they think of it as a diet, it doesn't. And so that's, in a sense, the kind of danger of Veganuary, because, you know, veganism is a justice-based philosophical position. And so to see it reduced to, you know, eating plants for a month can be quite frustrating from an activist point of view. And so I suppose what the grassroots are doing at the moment is trying to use Veganuary as an opportunity to educate about the ethics. And so that's really kind of, you know, what's going on, mm-hmm. in the sense that, I mean, Veganuary hasn't existed for very long, but it's kind of culturally embedded now. And, you know, the media take a lot of interest in it. And so, you know, it's kind of an opportunity, but it is important for us to get people to think about the ethical underpinnings to what they're eating, rather than just what they're eating in terms of something different, you know.
I guess it is an opportunity, though, when you're talking about the ethics. I think ethics to do with any subject, people can sometimes turn away from it because they almost don't want to compute the horror sometimes that can be involved with certain topics, you know, that's the truth. But
balancing, isn't it?
Yeah, and I guess Veganuary is almost an opportunity for activists like yourselves to, or yourself, I should say, to, I guess, introduce people as to why they would live a vegan lifestyle and would say eat plant-based. But then, you know, going out to the wider area of the situation, why you follow that lifestyle, how it benefits not only humans, but the animals of this world, in terms of environmentalism. Like, it goes, it's a large scope there. But that can be, I guess, the door can be opened to that thinking by just something like this, which may be taken as gimmicky, but that will introduce people to this whole new world that they knew nothing of, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. As I said, it is an opportunity, and it is something that we can build on. You know, but it is a limited idea in that sense, of the fact that it's very focused on celebrity and diet, that kind of thing. But if the grassroots get involved in terms of acting almost like as a bit of a corrective to Veganuary, then it might work in that kind of sense that you're suggesting, that, you know, people kind of, you know, opens out a kind of vista of the philosophical underpinnings. And I do agree with you that if people kind of experience that first, it can be a bit off-putting. So that's where the balance comes in. You know, do you try and, as it were, attract them with the behaviour change, or do you try to influence their attitudinal change? It's always a balance for social movements, and it's no different on this occasion.
What advice would you give people who are, would say, just in terms of diet-wise, would say they're partaking in Veganuary, but if they want to learn more, I guess, as to why certain people live this way and the activism behind it, what advice would you give them? You know, are there certain texts they should read? Are there certain documentaries they should watch to introduce them to the world of veganism? Rather than, as you say, sometimes when people do get overwhelmed, they do tend to turn away from topics.
Yeah, well, obviously, in the past life that we all used to lead, then people would turn to things like texts and books and everything, whereas, you know, that tends to be quite a challenge to get people to read anything nowadays. You know, people are fatigued about reading a tweet sometimes. But in terms of what they can watch, I would always recommend that they would tune in to the work of a philosopher called Tom Regan, who was the originator of rights-based animal rights. And that gives you then the underpinnings of what's going on. And once you understand that philosophical position about justice and peace and nonviolence, then everything about the diet falls into place. And so when you've got the full picture, then Veganuary makes sense. Because, I mean, like, Veganuary is kind of like, it's given an opportunity for a lot of people to come up and go, well, I tried veganism for X amount of weeks and it didn't work. And that's the frustrating thing for us, because they're conflating a plant-based diet with a philosophy. You know, they didn't actually try veganism, which is a philosophical stance. What they did is they ate vegetables for a while and it didn't work for them. You know, and so that's the frustration thing. So if people understand the philosophy, I think that helps them kind of understand what's going on. Yeah. In a more general sense.
Yeah, and I think that probably applies to everything in life, doesn't it? Dr. Roger mm-hmm. Yates, very interesting. And if you want some more information, you can go on to the Vegan Information Project online.